And welcome back to Coast with our special guest, John Bondichon. We're talking about his works, Amazing Dogs, Buried Alive. Share your stories, too, if you were buried alive, of course. But tell me about your dog stories, too. We'll talk more when we come right back. Welcome back. John Bondichon with us, of course. John, before we go to calls, when the Germans had these dogs, the super intelligent German shepherd dogs, I would assume, did they train them to be this way, or did these dogs have a special ability? What do you think it was?
Well, they didn't have any special ability, really. It was all a bit of a fad at the time that humans and dogs should be able to communicate. But in reality, the dogs actually reacted to hidden cues from their masters. For example, Rolf stopped tapping on the board when there was a slight movement to the board by the person holding it. So unconscious cues from the masters. So Rolf was really not more clever than other dogs. And the Nazis' interest in human-dog communication never had any positive results. It was just a waste of money, really.
The size of a dog's brain, did that have anything to do with its ability to communicate?
No, not really, because the large breeds have, some dogs have larger brains than other proportionally.
Yeah.
And we know that, for example, the Afghan hound has a small brain compared with its body size, and it's not a particularly clever dog. But then on the other hand, the pug and the French bulldog have large brains compared with their body weight amount, but then they're still not very clever. So it's not the size of the brain, it's probably the use the dog makes of it. And there is quite a span in intelligence between the various breeds of dogs. In the old days, of course, they believed that the Newfoundland dog was the most admirable and intelligent and sagacious of all dogs. And that's certainly not true today. But there was something about the Newfoundland dogs in the old days. They were not just large and handsome dogs. They also showed intelligence that is remarkable and more than you would associate with a dog today. There are many instances of Newfoundland dogs jumping into the sea from a ship with a rope to save a person drowning, or spontaneously leaping into Thames or into the Seine to save a person who is under threat of drowning. So there was something about them, but they were working dogs in those days, of course. They were bred on the fishing boats in Newfoundland at the time. And in modern times, they have just become idle pets. So they have lost all the edge, really. They've lost the working instincts that their breed once exhibited. And they've also lost some of the intelligence that they really had back in those days.
There was a breed called the turnspit dog, which was it used to spin wheels?
Yes, there were turnspit dogs both in Britain and in France and in the United States. And they were small, low, short-legged dogs. And they were bred to run inside a dog wheel to propel a turning spit.
Huh. And I think they're ground up meat, right?
Yeah, yes, a spit turning a roast beef or a roast venison or whatever they had.
Huh.
And they were spoken of already in 1576 in a book about dogs in this country. And they flourished in the 17th and 18th centuries, particularly in Wales and in the west of England. And they were used in America as well. There was a large tavern in Philadelphia that had several turnspit dogs at work back in the 18th century. And the turnspit dog, of course, didn't have a very agreeable life. I mean, running around in a wheel like a canine squirrel was not a particularly prepossessing existence, but at least sometimes they were kind to the turnspit dogs and let it eat some of the meat it had helped to roast. And there is still a tavern here in Wales, the Hanbury Arms in Caerleon, that had a turnspit dog as late as the 1860s, which at a time when the dogs had become quite obsolete, because at that time they had mechanical clock jacks driving the spits instead. And those clock jacks became cheaper and cheaper with time. So turnspit dogs became old-fashioned. They got out of date. And in the end, the turnspit dog became an extinct breed. So there
About
are
that.
no turnspit dogs today, although there were some as late as the end of the 19th century.
I mean,
There are many dog wheels still kept at various museums in this country, and I have even seen a stuffed turnspit dog. So the
oh my
only
God.
one is a stuffed turnspit dog that used to drive a wheel at the old shop in Cross Ash in South Wales, and it is today at the Abergavenny Museum.
All right, let's go to the phones for you now. We go to Bill in Hastings, Florida to get us started. Hey, Bill, good morning.
Morning, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Yeah, you were just talking about people being buried alive, so I thought your listeners would get a kick out of this one Irish
Okay.
song. It's called Finnegan's Wake. And they could access that just by tapping Finnegan's Wake into their computer and playing it. And
It's an oldie.
it's about a guy who's having he's passed away and he's having his wake, and eruption breaks out at his party and someone throws whiskey on him and he wakes up.
Oh,
It's a pretty funny
I
song.
love it.
And they might also get a kick out of this book that's called Ghosts of the Air by Martin Caden, who was a pilot. All kinds of interesting supernatural stories about ghosts and aircraft. And I got a couple of political things I could tell you too if you have any interest in hearing that.
Nah, we'll just keep
We'll skip
stay
the
on
politics
topic.
for now.
You got it. Hey, thanks. Appreciate it. Ghosts in the air. There was an Eastern Airlines flight that crashed. And everybody contends that there was some hauntings over that too. Have you ever written a book about ghosts out there, John?
Yes, I have written a chapter about dog ghosts in My
Dog
Amazing
ghosts?
Dogs. Yes, there are quite a few instances of dog ghosts. And a colleague of mine who lived in Richmond, just outside London, had quite a spooky dog ghost story to tell. He had three Newfoundland dogs, one of which was not less than 13 years old. It was the grandmother of the other two. And one day the old dog died, and since he had a very large garden, he buried the dog in a corner of the garden, hopefully not alive, buried alive that is, but it was certainly dead. And then he noticed that the other two dogs seemed, they didn't do a Greyfriars Bobby on the grandmother's grave, but they were instead very hilarious. They jumped over a fence and they played and they romped. And they dug a large hole in the neighbor's lawn. And then an old lady came to call, and she was the neighbor. And my friend thought that she had come to complain about the vandalized garden. But instead, she said she had very much admired those three Newfoundland dogs playing around. The old dog with the gray nose leading the way and playing pranks with the other two. And she saw the dog ghost once more just at dusk. She saw it looking at her from the garden, and then it slowly faded away.
I love it. Okay, Stacy's in Massachusetts. Hello, Stacy.
Hi, I have a dog story that a friend of mine told me a couple years
All right,
ago.
go ahead, share it with us.
Okay, when this happened, I didn't know her, but when her and her sister were little, she was 10, her sister were 5. They played house in the yard, and they had a collie. And she told her dog, "Now Bowser, you gotta go get some food for us, 'cause you're the dad." And the dog left and didn't think nothing of it. But 5 minutes later, he came with a little snack cake in his mouth. He went to the local AMP and got a snack cake off the rack, 'cause in the summertime in Kentucky, they had the doors open, you know.
Smart dog. Smart dog indeed. Carol's in Columbus, Ohio. Hello, Carol. It's your turn.
Hi.
Hi.
I have two little short stories I want to tell you.
Okay.
One of them, it was on public television decades ago, and some people went out looking at real old gravestones somewhere in the United States. I can't remember where, but they came to some extremely old graveyard.
Yeah.
And where gravestones were falling down and all that. But on this one, it said, "I told you I was sick." And then the other one is from a book I read called The Shipping News by Annie Proulx, P-R-O-U-L-X. One of the gentlemen in town had died, and people were at his wake, and he, of course, was lying there, and they were standing around talking or whatever you do at wakes. And all of a sudden, he started to cough. He sat up. He wasn't dead at all.
No, not dead at all. Boy, he's lucky they didn't put him under, that's for sure. In hospitals, does this happen a lot, John, where somebody dies and they come back?
Well, there have been instances in recent times. There was a scholarly paper from Ireland last year about people who actually make precautions even today to have an artery cut after they're dead because they are fearful of being buried alive. And when I was practicing as a doctor in Sweden, I spoke to an old doctor after I had given a talk about premature burial, and he had once had a patient who had asked to have the brachial artery cut after death, so they were certain that they were dead. And even George Washington himself made a precaution, because in his will he requested that he should be kept above ground for 3 days after his death to make sure he wasn't buried alive. And both Hans Christian Andersen and Alfred Nobel of Nobel Prize fame, they also made precautions in their wills to make sure they were not wrongly diagnosed as dead.
When this all started back when? 1700s, 1800s? The fear...
1740s, I would say, the premature burial hysteria started. And it was very... It was not a pan-European panic, because it was highest in Germany, where they had these hospitals for the dead, the waiting mortuaries all over Germany with their signaling machines connected to the corpses, and hospitals to incubate the corpses until they were putrid. And in France, there was also much agitation, but in a more positive way, because it's actually quite barbaric to build hospitals not for the living, but for the dead, and then to have them putrefy. In France, there was instead agitation to find better signs of death. I mean, the old signs of death of feeling for the pulse or putting a mirror to the mouth to see if it clouded over were not very good, really. And there were various cranky ideas, like putting an insect into the dead person's ear, or putting a pointed pencil, thrusting that up the nostril.
Ouch!
Or pull the tongue with a tongue-pulling machine, thrusting a needle inside the heart with a flag onto the needle.
Yeah, that would kill him.
The flag would wave merrily if the person was still alive.
If the heart was beating.
And blowing smoke up their ass as well. They think tobacco smoke was supposed to have a reviving effect on the corpse. So they blew. So they had a Doppelblaser.
Unbelievable! Unbelievable stuff.
Use of to blow his
Let's take some other calls here. Let's go to Julia in Salt Lake City. Julia, west of the Rockies, you're on the air with us. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a little dog that I adopted about 7 years ago now. And the first year that I had him, I got so sick, and because I couldn't get rest or sleep because I had noisy neighbors. and I overdosed accidentally.
Oh.
And I have one of those emergency buttons.
Right. Good.
And I had turned it off because I was so angry I didn't want to hear it. And the next thing I know, I'm in the hospital. My dog had turned that machine back on to get me some help.
She saved your life.
He saved my life.
That's a great story.
When he just comes and loves me now. He just gets so
How old is he now? How old is he?
He's 9 years old now.
Well, that's a pretty good age for a dog. It really is. They're great companions, I'll tell you. Any specific breed, John, that was smarter than the other?
Well, in the old days, the Newfoundland dog was supposed to be particularly intelligent. And there are some remarkable stories of Newfoundland dogs saving people from drowning or from falling down precipices. And there's also a story about a Newfoundland bitch named Princess May. She lived up north in Oldham, I think it was, in the north of England. And one day, a horse-drawn tram came down the hill, and a little boy was playing on the tram lines, and he couldn't get out of the way. He fell down. And people were tried to rush up to save the boy, but nobody was close enough. And then Princess May came dashing out from a garden and grabbed the boy and pulled him to safety. And there was something called the Humane Society at the time that rewarded heroic animals, and they investigated the story and took witness depositions. And quite a few people had seen the dog come rushing out without being prompted in any way, and then pull the little boy to safety. So the Princess May got a medal to wear on her collar, and she became the guest of honor at the large dog show in London.
How about that? How about that indeed? Okay, we're going to come back in a moment and take final phone calls as we wrap up the segments about buried alive and amazing dogs. And then next hour, we will start open lines here on Coast to Coast AM. John's websites and his links through Amazon are at coasttocoastam.com. So it's very easy for you to get to that. And also in terms of ours, don't forget to like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, send me an email anytime you want to george@coasttocoastam.com. And of course, also don't forget to become a Coast Insider. It is indeed 15 cents a day. And it's a great way to become part of the program. You simply go to coasttocoastam.com and fill out the information to be a Coast Insider right here on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour, open lines here on Coast to Coast AM, but we're going to come back in just a moment here and take some final phone calls with our guest, John Bondeschon, as we talk about his works, Buried Alive and Amazing Dogs, right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to our final segment with John Bondeschon. John, I would guess if anybody was being cremated and they were alive, they probably were literally cooked, right? They didn't wake up?
Well, there are horror stories, of course, of the coffin going through the crematorium oven and then there's a scream.
No.
Help, I'm not dead. I'm not dead.
No.
But in reality, cremation, the popularity of cremation owed its... something to the fear of being buried alive, and so did the practice of embalming, because you certainly couldn't come back to life after being embalmed.
Mm-hmm. That's
both,
true.
The popularity of both embalming and cremation was to some degree due to the fear of being buried alive. Yes.
When did embalming start?
It started already in the 19th century, but has become much more popular in our own time.
Yeah, it is. Okay, let's go to Deborah now in Iowa, first-time caller. Hello, Deborah.
Hello, George. How are you doing?
Good. Good to have you with us. What kind of a story or question do you have?
I have a story for you. My dad was born and raised up in Alaska on Sandpoint Island, and he had a sister, and she had died. And when they buried her, they dug the hole and they got ready to put her in the hole. And my dad said the hole started filling up with water. And then they, when they had put her in there, my dad said she had a nosebleed. And he said she couldn't have been dead.
Oh, that's scary.
Yeah, and he was just a kid.
That is a scary story. Ugh, gives me the chills.
I know. And he, you know, he'd tell us about that story, and he'd cry. You know, he.
Oh my God! Yeah.
Yeah, there was nothing I could do. He'd say, you know, I was just a kid. You know, what are you gonna do?
And there's not much you can do on something like that at all. My gosh. Did the newspapers of the day, John, write about stories like this?
Yes, there are regular reports of people of near misses of being buried alive. I remember when I did interviews for an American radio after Buried Alive was published, they all asked me about a case from New York State of a woman being diagnosed dead by a coroner, and then she woke up in the morgue. and there have been several instances since, in the UK, there was an old woman, a diabetic, who collapsed, and a doctor declared her dead, and then she woke up in the ambulance on the way to the morgue. And the careless doctor was sued. Doctor had probably been out partying and was early in the morning and was still drunk.
Yeah, exactly. Let's go to Tom, truck driving somewhere in Indiana. Tom, go ahead, sir.
Indianapolis tonight.
There you are. Perfect.
Anyway, so in 62, I was about 3 years old. But the story, what I get from my uncles in California, and they thought he was dead, so went down to the morgue, and from what the story that I've been told is that he was actually on the table, the medical examiner started working on him, he grabbed the arm of the medical examiner after, I don't know what all the procedures he was doing, but anyway, the one he had done, he had actually cut him, and my uncle bled out on the table, like, you know, because he doesn't have the like emergency room equipment or right. Stuff like that, and he actually died on the medical examiner table. And I guess on the death certificate it even says cause of death is autopsy.
Unbelievable.
I know it.
They
it
killed
just,
him
so killed him right there on the medical examiner table.
That happens a lot. You know, how many people die in hospitals, John, from negligence? Have you heard of that?
The newspapers are full of that kind of thing. But it was interesting to hear the story here of the man waking up on the autopsy table, because that's actually an old pan-European legend that goes back to the 16th century, to the time of Andreas Vesalius, the famous doctor. And he is said to have performed a post-mortem on a patient, and then the patient woke up, but it was too late to save him because of the damage the careless anatomist had already done. And that story then popped up again and again and again, and there were several of these popular stories going back to the 14th and 15th centuries. And one was the lady with the ring. So a wealthy German lady is buried with her wedding ring on her finger. And the gravedigger sees the ring and he decides to exhume her
during nighttime
and steal the ring. And when he cuts off the finger to take the ring, the lady wakes up.
Ouch.
And that story has been repeated with various names for the protagonist since the 14th century, and several illustrations from modern times, and it even recurs in one of Guy de Maupassant's short stories.
Has the legend of vampires and Dracula contribute to any of these stories of being buried alive?
They do cross each other, and there was an old thesis back in the early 18th century about the chewing of dead people. So dead people coming to life, and they were chewing their shrouds, eating their shrouds in the coffins. So the undead, really, the vampiristic view of things. And that thesis was then quoted in several books about premature burial.
Okay, next up, we've got Kathy in Bakersfield, California now. Hello, Kath. Go ahead.
Hello, George.
Yeah, hi.
When I was a teenager, I have a dog story. When I was a teenager, I always wanted a dog. I got a Pembroke Welsh Corgi. I took him to obedience school, trained him. We were inseparable, went everywhere together. I accidentally was tossing in clothing into my car to go to the laundromat. I put my dog inside, turned around, closed the door, didn't realize it, turned around again. I had locked the doors. So my little corgis locked inside of my car.
He's trapped.
The sun's beating down.
Oh.
He's in the front seat. I see him panting, and I'm just
freaking out.
Yes, and here in Bakersfield, it gets really, really hot in the summertime. So I know he's going to die. So I point to the lock. In those days, the lock sticks up.
Yeah.
And I told him to get it. He knew how to fetch, but he didn't know anything about door locks. So he starts to put his nose near the lock, and I said, yes, get it. So he put his mouth on it, pulled the lock.
No.
Up, unlocked it.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, and I told my vet, I took him to the vet about a week or so later for shots, and I told him about it. He says, I've heard a lot of stories. I don't believe it. I said, okay.
I believe you.
Let's go out, and I'll prove it to you. So we walked out to my car. I put the dog inside. This time I had the keys.
Yeah, the keys, just in case, right?
And closed the door, and he did it again. And the vet said, if I hadn't seen it with my own eyes, I wouldn't have believed it.
That's a smart dog.
He was a great dog.
I love it. That's a great story.
Pembroke Welsh Corgi,
breed. That is a super story. I love it. What's your next book, John? What are you going to work on?
Well, my next book will be out in just a few weeks' time. It's called Rivals of the Ripper, about unsolved murders of women in London from the 1860s until the 1890s. So a lot of mysterious murder stories from the Victorian era.
Sounds like a cult.
Very well illustrated, and will be published in this country, but it will be available on US Amazon as well. So if you want to chew over a few good murder mysteries, that's the book to get, really.
Here's another idea for a book for you, too, and that is people who wake up during surgery because the anesthesia wore off.
Well, I leave the writing of that particular book to the anesthesiologist. I am not a specialist in that area, but it does happen, of course. There are quite a few of those stories going around because people are quite different with regard to their ability to metabolize the anesthetic agent. So some of them are very sensitive. They go under with a very small dose, whereas others are quite resistant to the anesthesia. So it's just human physiology.
Let's go to Joe in the Bronx. Hello, Joe. Go ahead.
George, how are you?
Good.
I have a question for you guys, John. Has there ever been an incident where, like you mentioned cemetery dogs earlier, and you know, they're missing their masters and going on guard at their gravesite. Has there ever been an incident where maybe a breed like a Newfoundland has dug up the coffin?
No, there has not, actually. There is a story from Sweden about a Newfoundland becoming a cemetery dog. It's from a port in the north of Sweden where an English ship was loaded with timber. So they brought timber, or they exported timber, rather, from Sweden to Britain. And the captain's wife died, and she was buried in the local cemetery. And the captain's Newfoundland dog was taking part of the funeral. And after half a year, the ship came back, and then the Newfoundland dog ran as hard as it could back to the cemetery. It wouldn't go back onto the ship, and it kept vigil on the captain's wife's gravestone. And that story was repeated in quite a few Swedish newspapers at the time, but it sounds rather too good to be true, though, because Newfoundland dogs were expensive in those days, and would a captain really have left his dog behind to become a cemetery dog when the ship was to leave for Britain? So personally, I'm a disbeliever of that particular story, and there's never been any attempt from the dog to dig up the coffin. Although the original cemetery dog was actually a suicidal dog, a dog that lost all will to live after the master had died. And then the cemetery dog metamorphized into a dog keeping vigil at the grave. But in reality, there's no truth to these stories, because the cemetery dog is just a canine vagabond, really, that likes to get food and to get shelter and to have his then the dog chances upon a cemetery, and it comes walking along, and people think it's mourning its master. They're bringing the dog food, and it gets shelter nearby in some shed, and of course it never leaves, because it has a perfectly good life. And dogs are by nature territorial, so making the cemetery their territory is perfectly natural.
John, have you always been interested in the unusual, the kind of strange?
Yes, I have, from a very early age, since I was a medical student. I do write a regular column in the Fortean Times, which is a magazine about the strange and the bizarre.
Great publication.
It is indeed, yes. Still keeping alive after many years.
Let's go to Felix in Pennsylvania now. Hello, Felix. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Good morning, George. Good morning, John. Hey, I got actually two interesting stories.
All right.
My parents grew up in Germany, World War II Germany, okay? And my mother, they had the air raid, so they would go to bomb shelters, right? Well, the family had this little dachshund, Nelly, and one day the sirens went off. And the dog would not let anybody into the bomb shelter. It was barking and biting at people, so they decided to go to another bomb shelter. And the one the dog kept them out took a direct hit.
Wow.
Yep.
A clairvoyant dog.
Yeah. Now, this next story, don't be too judgmental. It was about my wife's grandfather.
All right.
And he passed away in the 60s, so it was a different day and age, okay? He was a commercial fisherman.
Okay.
And he used to come home, and some stray cats started coming to his house. And he tried his best to get rid of the cat. He would take it for drives, you know, and drop it off. And he'd get home, the cat would be there, right? Well, he was a commercial fisherman. He used to go out in the ocean, you know, for a week at a time. So finally, after all the frustration, he decided to take the cat out on the fishing trip. And he didn't have the heart to outright kill it, but he set it adrift on top of, a fish crate.
Oh,
cover.
No.
Yeah, well, check this out. So after a week of fishing, he actually started feeling really guilty about the whole thing. He came home. The cat was sitting on his front steps.
Go figure.
Okay. Now, this was out off of Long Island. So, you know, you got the bay, then you got Fire Island, right? So the cat made it all the way across. And
found his house.
Found the house. And so my wife's grandfather, whenever he came home, he always brought a fish for the cat. It became his best friend.
That's a great story. I like that. What makes some of these animals so perceptive, John? So intuitive, like that cat?
With regard to, I stay away from the feline tribe and concentrate on
the dogs, right?
Dogs are really very perceptive indeed. One example, of course, is the German super intelligent dogs and the various performing dogs reacting to minute hidden cues from their masters. So Rolf stopped tapping his paw on the board when there was a slight movement of the board. because his owner expected him to stop hitting it, because that would be the correct letter for the word he was trying to spell.
That was the way to do it indeed. So, any parting thoughts here, John, as we're wrapping things up here?
Well, my book is Amazing Dogs, published by the Cornell University Press back a few years ago. And it's a very handsome-looking book with color plates, which is an uncommon thing nowadays, with old illustrations of various dogs from my own collection. I have a couple of hundred books about dogs and quite a few old prints and postcards. I have an entire album of postcards with dogs on them, which I have used for illustrations for my various books. And there's also one book about Greyfriars Bobby, which is called Greyfriars Bobby, the most faithful dog in the world. And then there is Amazing Dogs, and then there is those amazing Newfoundland dogs. So an entire book about the history of the Newfoundland dog, the history of the breed.
Thank you, John. You're very prolific indeed. This was fun, fascinating, and thank God we're not ones who wake up and realize we've been buried alive. Gosh, that's got to be horrible. Absolutely horrible. Hey, let's go into open lines next. Whatever's on your mind, that'll be next on Coast to Coast AM.